Good morning. I hope everyone is doing okay this morning. So, this morning is, I think probably everybody's aware, is September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on people, buildings on the United States. And this morning, I want to talk about the ninth precept. So I'm still talking about the meaning of the Bodhisattva ceremony. And we are talking about this morning, I'm going to talk about the ninth precept. The ninth precept is, I vow not to harbor ill will, which I think is really appropriate, considering that this is 9/11. I would say that the actions of the planners, the perpetrators, etc., of 9/11 is based on an extreme case of harboring ill will. So this is what happens when we don't pay attention to this precept. The precept itself in the Bodhisattva ceremony is, I vow not to harbor ill will, not negative, not positive, neither real nor unreal. There is an ocean of illuminated clouds and an ocean of bright clouds. So first let's start out by talking about the basic precept without the verse, which is, we would say in Buddhism, the relative side of this precept. The verses are about viewing the precept from the position of our Buddha mind, which is where we would not necessarily have to work on even thinking about this precept per se, because we would have so incorporated the interconnection, the results of our actions, that we would not need to have this admonition. But I want to start out by talking about it from an admonition point of view, because really, we need that. We need that. So, what does it mean to harbor ill will? It means that we're holding on to negative feelings towards another person or a situation, in the case of 9/11, harboring ill will towards the United States. And what they believe that we stood for. So that's ill will, but there's a side of harboring. I think this is a really important part of the precept. Harboring means to shelter something. So we're sheltering, we're giving home to our ill will in our mind. We're giving home to a kind of hate. We're giving home to this anger, if you will, that comes from our ill will. We're allowing it to grow and thrive in our mind. We're feeding it. Ill will, harboring and having ill will is about feeding this feeling. Our mind essentially becomes a place for ill will, a place for negativity. It becomes a home for this kind of thinking. It becomes a habit. So we harbor, we give a safe haven to unwholesome thoughts. So we avoid this by paying attention to our thoughts and identifying when we are caught by ill will. And then when we see that we are caught in ill will, we ask ourselves, is this helpful? And we also actually feel the suffering in our bodies. Because when we're angry or harboring ill will or feeling hate and negative thoughts, we can feel this in our body. So we pay attention to the suffering that we are actually experiencing, and we use that as a way to, maybe in some ways you could say selfishly, but as a way to redirect our thinking. Do the work of transformation. Because we want to be free from suffering. And because we want to be free from this suffering, we practice. We practice with the precepts, among other things. So practice begins with doubting, questioning the very thoughts we're having that are causing us to experience ill will. When I was younger, in my 20s, there was an expression called question authority. And it meant question the government, question the police, question whomever one thought was in authority. Let's question our minds. Let's question the authority that we give to the thoughts that we have. It's as if we have a thought and somehow that's like the tablets coming down from the mountain. So please, keep questioning this mind. So we need to make this question. We need to question our thinking because it's what generates the suffering that we experience. So do not misunderstand what I'm saying. I am not suggesting that you are never taken advantage of or wronged or something like that, nor am I suggesting that we shouldn't do anything about it. But I am suggesting that there is a way that we can reframe and change our response to that. So the precept is talking about the root feeling, an attitude. It's talking about how we interpret our experience. In the Dharmapada, which is a very early Buddhist text, some say the earliest, in the Dharmapada it says, our life is shaped by our mind. We become what we think. Joy follows a pure thought like a shadow that never leaves. Our life is shaped by our mind. We become what we think. Joy follows a pure thought like a shadow that never leaves. And then after this line, here's an example of an unwholesome, spiraling down kind of thinking. The quote is, and you're probably familiar with this, he was angry with me, he attacked me. Or we could say, they were angry with me, they attacked me, they defeated me, they robbed me. Those who dwell on such thoughts will never be free from hatred. They were angry with me, they attacked me, they defeated me, they robbed me. Those who do not dwell on such thoughts will surely become free from hatred, for hatred can never put an end to hatred. Ill will can never put an end to a wrong. So the point of this verse is we do not harbor, we don't feed this anger, this hurt, this blaming mind. That we don't harbor this and cultivate this. We don't want a mind that interprets and perceives every slight as something to hold on to in a way in which it creates ill will, in which it just keeps generating itself over and over. Even big slights, big things. Buddhism asked us to transform our minds and have a different relationship. So if we harbor ill will, this leads to anger or other possible violent acts, such as in our case, because I hope that there is no one here listening to this lecture who would consider flying an airplane into a building. But that's an extreme, extreme version of ill will. What about the ill will that we engage in as individuals? So we must meet our practice where we are right now, not say, oh, I would never do this thing. We should ask ourselves about harsh speech, physically harming ourselves or another, allowing to fester, our emotions to fester, allowing emotional and mental suffering. This ill will is like a cancer that eats away at your happiness and joy. It destroys your equanimity. And fundamentally allowing this kind of emotion to continue in your mind will have dire effects on yourself and others. One of the commentaries on the verse from the Dharmapada says that this kind of mental trap, if you will, is like wrapping a rotting fish in straw. We don't want to take this rotting fish and put it in straw. It may look okay on the outside, but you can smell it from very far away. So, what are the antidotes to this kind of thinking? What are the antidotes in Buddhism? And I have to say to you, these are difficult. When we are caught in saying to ourselves, he wronged me, she wronged me, this is wrong, I feel outrage, these people are bad. However we frame this kind of thinking to ourselves and justify this kind of thinking, it means that we're pretty caught up in this. So doing these practices is hard. A traditional way of talking about this, I'm going to offer about four of these. A traditional way to work with ill will is to remember in a past life that you yourself caused harm. And so in this way, it's to cultivate patience in the face of this is a way that you cultivate merit. It's a way that you help eradicate and work through your karma from a past lifetime by being patient. But, you know, we don't need to reach back to a past lifetime. All we have to do is remember our own mistakes. They may not be the same ones that we are aggrieved about, but guaranteed, as human beings, we have done something that's unskillful to someone else or to ourselves. We have engaged in some kind of harmful action. And so we want to say to ourselves, how would I like to be treated when I make this kind of mistake? How do I want someone to respond to me? Or how has someone responded to me in the past that has allowed me to open my heart, that's allowed me not to feel defensive? So can we cultivate that mind? And one way we cultivate that mind is to humble ourselves, essentially, by remembering that we're not perfect either, and that we've made mistakes ourselves, so that we create a kind of equanimity towards this person that we want to call the enemy, that we are making into our enemy. As soon as we make someone into our enemy, all of a sudden all bets are off. There's this way in our mind that we perpetuate the idea that we can just kind of respond any old way we want to. Because after all, they're our enemy. They don't deserve our respect. This is really not a good way to think about relationships. So we can reflect on the fact that others and our actions, here's another one way to talk about this, is to sit down and say, you know, and recognize that everyone comes from their own causes and conditions. We have the causes and conditions of our own life, which is causing us to respond in this way to what is that we perceive as harming. We have our own, that other person has their own causes and conditions for why they're engaging in unskillful action. And then there is remembering that we are all in this together. And also remembering societal life, the causes and conditions of our society that cause us to have certain ways of thinking about things. So that's the second one. The first one has to do with remembering our own karma and the mistakes that we have made. The second one is remembering that this isn't just all about one thing, this one person, this one situation, that this situation has arisen out of very complicated things. Shantideva has an example of, if you're walking along the street and a branch from a tree suddenly falls on your head, do you cut down the tree? Do you cut down the tree and burn it down because it did this thing to you? Because the causes and conditions are such with a tree that we understand that maybe the branch was rotting. Maybe the wind was blowing. There are many causes and conditions that could cause that branch to fall on us. What about the causes and conditions of why were we walking under the branch in the first place? That moment of walking under the branch. How could you blame that moment? The causes and conditions of the people who flew into the towers, the Twin Towers, the causes and conditions that that person went to work that day. All those things come together. The causes and conditions of the societal mindset of everybody involved in the process of everything that happened. So much complicated interrelating relationships are going on there. So that's the second one, that we actually remember that. Having done this, we realize, when we do this, we realize that the actions of the other person, the actions that cause them to do harm, are not entirely the other person's fault. And this is a tough one. But it goes back to, is it the tree's fault that a branch fell on your head? This is not about absolving someone from responsibility for their actions. It's about, A, dealing with your own suffering and not creating and perpetrating and harboring ill will. And B, it's about how do you generate a skillful response? Because if you're caught up in the desire of wanting to hate, the desire to get back at someone, the desire for revenge, if you're caught up in all of that, punishment, wanting to punish, you are not going to be skillful in your response. So this is all about how do I create a skillful response, and also, what goes along with that by extension, how do I alleviate my own suffering, selfishly alleviate my own suffering of the overwhelming feelings that this generates, as well as the suffering of others who are involved. So when we create this more skillful response, maybe it shows up as being a better listener. Maybe we're more patient and give more space. Maybe we drop our attachment to how we're thinking about things if it's not particularly helpful. But what is not generated here is the desire to punish the other person. Or sometimes these ill will we actually have towards ourselves. We did something wrong and now we're caught up in all this ill will and harboring, oh, I did this again, I'm a terrible person, I'm always doing this thing. That's harboring ill will too against the self. And so to let go of the desire to punish and destroy. Another way we could work with this is maybe we sit down and we meditate on sending this person goodwill. We say, and we've all heard this, we say, may you be happy. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from the root of suffering that has caused this harm. Usually for everybody, this is a tough one. The idea of actually sitting down and wishing goodwill towards this person who's harmed you. Maybe we put a picture on our altar of this person and we offer incense and we say that person's name and we say, I hope your day is a good one. Very radical. Mostly when we're harboring ill will, this is the last thing we want to do. Can you bow down to that person? Oh, I can't believe it. My teacher said to me, can you actually put their name on the altar and like do three bows to this person? No, I don't want to do that. So That's another way that we can work with this. We can ask ourselves if we're offended by what the, if the case of somebody saying something to us or having some belief that we don't agree with. Are we offended because this person has impugned our own self-image? Are the self-image or our image of someone that we love? You know, Buddhism, we have this saying, Shanti David talks about this, he says, you know, Buddhism doesn't need protection. We don't need to go on the warpath to protect some Buddhist thing because somebody maligned some Buddhist teaching. Buddhism can take care of Buddhism because Buddhism is so much solidly itself, knowing its true self, that we don't need to take care of it. We just need to practice it, and the practicing it is what takes care of Buddhism, not defending Buddhism. So we don't need to whip ourselves up into a froth about something. If we need to do something, again, please do something. But the question is, how do we do? How do we respond? Do we respond with anger, seething, with ill will, a big stinky fish wrapped in straw? Or do we respond with equanimity and skill that's appropriate to whatever it is that we need to deal with? So again, this is a very difficult practice. You have to sit down with yourself and go over and over again to use tools to create transformation. You can sit down and you can say, I can't stand this person. I am so upset about this. I harbor so much ill will. And you can say to yourself, what is my vow? What is my bodhisattva vow? How do I ideally want to respond to these situations with others? Do I really want to carry around hurt and anger and ill will and revenge thoughts? Or do we want to be part of the solution? Do we want to open up our heart? Do we want to work with our own difficulties and the difficulties of others? Do we want to remember our bodhisattva vow to benefit all beings? Or maybe, again, you know, what is your personal vow? Not to be angry, not to be greedy, but in a very specific way that we recall this vow. We open our hearts by recalling this vow. We make ourselves soft and pliable. And this is something you can do, you do alone. You know, you sit down and do this alone. You don't have to go to the other person. Sit down and do this alone. So think about it. Think about the things that I mentioned earlier. Say to yourself, what are the causes and conditions of this person's life? What do I know about them? Or maybe I don't know anything about them, but I'm going to assume that they're acting this way because they're caught in their own causes and conditions, because they've been harmed in their past. And I also know that I've been harmed in my past, and I'm getting my buttons pushed because of the causes and conditions of my own life. To sit down and deconstruct that, pay attention to that. We say to ourselves, can I really be so outraged when I myself have caused harm to others? You say, when I have caused harm, can I remember people who have given me the space to heal and recover from my unskillful actions? Can I have a generous heart and mind when this person, with this person that I want to say is an enemy? I think every one of us has had the experience, I hope we have, of someone else being generous with our unskillfulness, which has allowed us to respond in a generous way, instead of being defensive, because a lot of times when you're doing things that are unskillful and people are confrontational with you and right in your face, your response is to be defensive. So let's be generous with each other as much as we can. Can we consider that this person also suffers and that their unskillful actions towards me come from that suffering? Or can we think that our desire to harbor ill will comes from our own suffering? You know, our mind's going to argue with us about that. Our mind's going to come up with all the reasons why we should harbor ill will. We're going to sit down and we're going to say all this stuff, and then our mind's going to say, yeah, but that person did this thing to me. Yep, they did this thing. I hate them. They're horrible. I'm suffering. You say, they were angry with me. They did attack me. They did defeat me. They did rob me. I hate this person. How can you ask me to have equanimity in the face of this? And then, like the other side of your mind, your little Buddha nature mind comes up and it says, okay, take a deep breath. Let's think about the causes and conditions. Let's think about my own suffering and how it feels. Relax. Do the practice. And then your small mind comes up and says, I don't want to do this practice. I want to harbor ill will. And then you say, just like a parent, you say, no, we're going to do this again. Patiently, we're going to go through this practice again. And eventually, you wear it out. So we keep returning to the practice over and over again. We recall, we practice with, because with these various techniques, because essentially our belief and faith in our practice is that they are true. That this is the mind that we want. We want a generous mind. We want to be compassionate, not stupid about it. We're not saying, come run me over. We're saying, I want to cultivate equanimity so I can face and look at this problem in a way that is the most helpful and the most skillful. That's our practice. Over and over again, in the midst of our resistance to doing the practice, because practice is hard. If your practice doesn't have some hard places in it, I would like to suggest that maybe you're not practicing. It's like this, the Buddhist practice is asking of us that we transform ourselves and allow to come forward our deepest, truest nature, which is the nature of Buddha. And the nature of Buddha is a nature that cultivates skillfulness and compassion and wisdom. And as puny little human beings, that can be really tough sometimes. We have to be kind to ourselves. We need to be kind. And also at the same time, maybe sometimes we need to be, please sit down. Please do this practice now. Because if you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? So we don't want to harbor ill will. We don't necessarily, we don't have to forget about it. We don't have to forget that this person is unskillful. We don't have to, like, not pay attention to that. But we want to forgive in the sense that we want to do these practices, cultivate generosity and compassion, and find a skillful way to respond. We don't drop our discernment about a person or a situation, but we do transform the way that we engage. It's not about punishing. It's not about retribution. We want to cultivate our own peace of mind. We want to calm our suffering. Harboring ill will is not an antidote to suffering. That's what our small mind thinks. Every one of the precepts, if you flip them, every one of the precepts is a way that our small mind says, I'm going to alleviate my suffering. I'm going to steal to alleviate my suffering. I'm going to say tacky things about other people to alleviate my suffering. I'm going to harbor ill will and I'm going to alleviate my suffering that way. But you know what? It doesn't work. I'm going to be addicted to something because it alleviates my suffering. And the thing about it is we do all these things because we're trying to alleviate our suffering. We think that that's going to help us. But inevitably, it leads us down a rabbit hole where we really, really are suffering. And then what happens is we're lying on the ground, our tongue is hanging out, and we're saying, "Uncle, I can't do this anymore." And then we go, "Okay, I'm going to practice. I'm going to do the practice." And then we start rising up out of this. So we are in the business of working towards equanimity. And this equanimity radiates out into the world, and it changes other people's suffering as well. And that's the meaning of the non-dual aspect of this precept, which I will remind you is not negative, not positive, neither real nor unreal. There is an ocean of illuminated clouds and an ocean of bright clouds. Not negative, not positive, neither real or unreal. There is an ocean of illuminated clouds and an ocean of bright clouds. So if we understand about not harboring ill will and do that work, we understand at that point that there is no reified view such as positive or negative, real or unreal. There is just this moment's response. Just this moment's response. Robert Aiken translates the precepts. He says, in the mind of the bodhisattva, there is no, whatever it is. In this case, in the mind of the bodhisattva, there is no ill will. When our mind is freed from delusion, from being caught, it would never occur to us to break the precepts. That's what this is talking about. In the mind of the bodhisattva, there is not whatever that is, because it just doesn't even occur in that person's mind. In this case, we would never harbor ill will. It just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't arise in our mind. But the thing about this is we are humans, and it does arise in our mind. And our aspiration is that we function in a clear space of a freed mind. And this liberation of this freed mind is based on not negative, not positive, neither real nor unreal. This is the liberation of pure response to a situation, to a person, not caught by our small mind, not caught by our erroneous perceptions based on rigid and dualistic thinking. This is the meaning of not negative, not positive, not real or unreal. Not real or unreal is not getting caught in emptiness and not getting caught in duality. Not getting caught in saying, oh, this isn't real, therefore it's nihilistic, you become nihilistic, or this is real, therefore you reify it, concretize it into something that cannot be spacious in your mind. You cannot find generosity. So when we find the mental stability, then we see that the world is an ocean of illuminated clouds and an ocean of bright clouds. This great ocean is a metaphor for all of reality functioning. It is the ocean of awakening, the ocean of merit, the ocean of compassion, the ocean of skillful response, and the ocean of patience. The illuminated clouds are those afflictions that beset us, and yet they are glowing. They are, as they are glowing, as they are transformed by this great ocean of the Dharma. These are not clouds of darkness. They are clouds illuminated by the sun with rays of compassion and interbeing shining down upon this great ocean of reality's functioning, this great ocean of your life, your relational and personal life. These illuminated clouds, these bright clouds, they're the same clouds. Each of our lives, each of our problems, our difficulties can become illuminated clouds. So this is the bigger picture. These verses are referring to kind of the bigger picture of our practice, the bigger ocean of our world. We are like the great ocean of the waves coming in to the shore. Each wave coming in, each moment coming in, each person arising and falling, each situation arising and falling, each thing like a wave, but always the ocean, always the ocean. Dogen quoted the Song Dynasty master, Zen master Zhao Do, in the Tenzo Kyokan, and this is the verse that he quotes. The dragon's jewels are found in every wave. Looking for the moon, it is here in this wave and the next. The dragon's jewels, this compassionate, awake, practical, appropriate, skillful, that's what realization is, response. It is in every moment, each wave of the great ocean of the illuminated clouds, each wave of this ocean. We are looking for the moon. We are looking for the moon for realization somewhere else other than in each wave. If you are at the ocean on a moonlit night, the moon is in every wave. The full moon is reflected in every wave. It is not different from every wave, every moment, every life, every situation coming to the shore in this wave, in the next. In every wave, looking for the moon, it is here in this wave. Thank you very much.